Washington County, and they need your help, so don't forget. Hey, we're going to have a great show today. Thanks for tuning in. Last call, as you know, focuses on addictions, chemical dependency issues, and we're going to take a little different slant on that today, and here's why. I have on the phone, I believe, because I locked it in here. I hope it's him. Joshua Kors. Josh, you there?
I sure am, Dan.
Hey,
great to be with you.
Hey, thanks so much for calling. You're in New York, I believe.
That's right.
And it's great to have you with us. This morning's a little later for you, but thanks for getting up so early on a Saturday, Josh, and calling last call. Really appreciate it.
And to think it's been 6 years since reporting for the Spectrum.
That's right.
Good to be back.
Yeah, you know, I've got to share with the listeners, too. Josh and I met when he worked here at the Spectrum. And ace reporter that he is, and he did an article on this show, Last Call, and entitled it The Crusader on the Mic, and it was a great article. It's still, you can access that on Josh's website, joshuakors.com. That's Joshua, K-O-R-S.com, and he's got all kinds of stuff. That's a magnificent website, and we're going to be talking about some of those things today. Josh, thanks again. I really appreciate you for you coming on. You've been a busy guy with all the stuff you have going on. Radio and TV with regard to an article you wrote for Nation magazine that just came out. So let's talk about it. It has to do with the troops and some short shrift they're getting, it appears. Can you elaborate a little bit?
Absolutely. I did a cover story for Nation magazine, a major political magazine out here in New York City, about... Well, it started out as a profile of Specialist John Town, a soldier who was struck by a rocket in Ramadi, Iraq, lost most of his hearing because of that attack, and was given the Purple Heart to honor his wounds. But when it came time to discharge him, the military decided that his deafness was actually caused by a pre-existing personality disorder. And discharging him that way, they were able to prevent him from collecting disability or medical benefits for the rest of his life. Another small print provision in that personality disorder discharge was that he, like thousands of other wounded soldiers, had to give back their signing bonus for the years they were too sick to serve, so that on his final day in uniform, he found out he actually owed the Army several thousand dollars. And his story got me digging. I found out in the past 6 years, 22,500 soldiers have been discharged with this personality disorder. Cheating those veterans out of their benefits is saving the military $12.5 billion in disability and medical care.
Wow, that is just unbelievable. That's I have no reason to doubt the veracity of your research and investigation. Obviously, then it's motivated by money.
Money's a big part of it. Yeah, I've been researching this story and this discharge mechanism for the last 8 months, and. You know, where this comes from is really something that congressional hearings are going to have to look at. In fact, the article has kicked up quite a stir that those congressional investigations are beginning in just a few days at Fort Carson, Colorado. The Government Accountability Office is now looking into the misuse of this personality disorder discharge. Money is a big factor. There's also a practical aspect with hospitals that are simply overrun with wounded soldiers. Nobody expected the war to go on this long or to produce this many wounded. When you have an overflow like this, personality disorder discharge is a really enticing option for doctors because it gets the soldier out the door in about 5 days. If they diagnose them correctly as wounded, rather than as too ill to serve before they joined the military, well, they did that, it would take about 6 months to go through a medical board, process papers. This way, they could usher them out the door freeing up the space for the five or six soldiers who are waiting to take that bed.
You know, I, as you know, I've been working in the field of chemical dependency, substance abuse, and addictions and like that for two decades. I have met many, many people with personality disorders, and I don't believe I've met one that has any deafness or hearing impairment. For what that's worth, I just find it reprehensible that they could slough off something that's obviously or apparently created by another cause.
You have to have a really dark sense of comedy to look at the medical reports of these cases, because it's all in the Army's own medical documents. What you see is perfectly healthy soldiers in the first screening, when the soldiers first join the Army, and healthy yet again in their screening before deploying for Iraq. It's only when they are wounded there and come back seeking benefits that this pre-existing condition is discovered. And you mentioned Specialist Towns' deafness. I looked at the case of Richard Dykstra, whose bilateral hernia suffered in Iraq was seen as the result of personality disorder. William Wooldridge, whose schizophrenic delusions after a terrible accident that resulted in the death of a young girl in Iraq, that really was the breaking point for him. Later, he was haunted by her ghost in Arkansas at his apartment. She would come to him at night asking why he had killed her. And they decided those delusions were a pre-existing personality disorder. And, you know, one of the reasons I was very interested in coming on your show, because chemical dependency really does fit hand in glove with this false diagnosis setup the military has set up. When these soldiers get this fake diagnosis and fake discharge of personality disorder, that means they don't get the treatment for what they really have. And at that point, so many of them turn to chemical dependency, drugs or alcohol, to solve whatever challenges they're actually facing. In some cases, it goes even further. I think of the case of Chris Mosier, who was perfectly healthy, according to everyone's viewpoint, went to Iraq and watched several of his friends burn to death in the truck in front of him. He was there at the end to pick up the hands and the arms of his friends. After that, he was never quite the same. And when he came back with schizophrenic-type delusions, the Army decided he had personality disorder. They gave him about 5-6 days of treatment and sent him home. He put a note on the door of his Des Moines, Iowa home saying that the Iraqis were after him there in Iowa and he had to save the family, and then shot himself.
Wow. So, that's a sad story. So apparently the personality disorder is a catch-all for is like a valve, a safety valve for the military to get out from under some long-term obligations financially and medically.
Yeah. That's right. They're using it for pretty much anything at this point, when in reality, according to the military's own regulations, it's a very specific condition, a psychological condition so severe that one would be too ill to serve from their very first day on base. In Specialist John Towns' case, he had already been serving for 7 years and won a dozen medals for his performance before this pre-existing condition was discovered.
Wow, that's incredible. Ladies and gentlemen, Joshua Kaur is a freelance writer and has been around for a long time. Guy, you've worked a lot of different places. Josh, you've not only worked at places, but you've been involved with the radio, TV, from the West Coast to the East Coast and all around. And, of course, you, as we mentioned, you were here at the Spectrum, our own local newspaper here in Washington County and beyond in Utah. And you are an award-winning writer, I happen to know. And I want to reiterate Josh's website, joshuacoars.com, and go there if you should be so kind. And and click on the, there's a, an icon in the upper right corner that will take you right to this article that Josh wrote for Nation Magazine. Now, Josh, with this in mind, and I'm sure you have tons more information from your thorough investigating, what's the next step? You mentioned some hearings in Colorado. Is this going to be a protracted thing that goes on for 75 years to try to get out from under this?
Well, I don't think so. You know, the investigation from Congress is coming just this next week, and we'll see where that leads. Nine senators, including Barack Obama, Barbara Boxer, Joseph Lieberman, Republican Kit Bond, have all signed a statement demanding an investigation of this personality disorder scandal. You know, another subset of these problems is a regulation on malingering, which is an army term for faking it.
Yeah.
A lot of these soldiers come back complaining of post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms, and they'll go to their army doctors seeking treatment. The doctors will accuse them of faking it. And so at that point, what option do they have? A lot of them say, well, if they're not going to treat me, I'll treat myself.
Or self-medicate, right.
Yeah. With alcohol, with amphetamines. And that becomes a sad situation for the soldiers in many ways. First, addiction is tragic, however you slice it. But just from a pure regulatory point of view, when they get caught with drugs, be it something as weak as marijuana or some as serious as ecstasy, they can be discharged with a dishonorable discharge, and all of the benefits they were hoping to fight for go immediately out the window.
That's a great point. That's a really an excellent point. And back to malingering, Josh, I know that's a very real thing. However, your reference to a person, mostly I think you said it was, that watched several people burn to death before his very eyes is certainly something that I think would naturally malinger in anyone's psyche for the rest of their life.
There's no doubt about it. I think all of your listeners will agree. There's nothing more heinous than sending troops off to war, putting them in harm's way in a way that truly leaves them injured, and then telling them they're faking their symptoms when they come back and seek medical help. As one of the soldiers said to me, after he went in and was given this false personality disorder discharge and ushered out the door, he said nobody in his unit would seek medical help because they know what the punishment would be.
Joshua, you mentioned some 22,000 figure, I think you said, that potentially have received basically the same treatment. Is that a pretty current figure today?
Yeah, 22,500 soldiers across the armed forces in just the last 6 years alone. Since my article was published, I've spoken with many figures, including Frank Ochberg, the doctor who codified the post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis for the government. And he said this problem has been going on for a long time, that back in the days before post-traumatic stress disorder, either you got a fake diagnosis like personality disorder or nothing. There was no alternative. At least now there are a select few who are learning about this, you know, personality disorder scandal, know to fight for a medical board and to push for their post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury symptoms to be recognized by a medical board and collect those disability and medical benefits.
Yeah, I'd like to just paint a little scenario here from my perspective as a non-military. I was never in the military. It was a drafted at one time, but due to a medical issue, they classified me a 1Y, which saved me from going to Vietnam, if that were the word. But I was looking at a soldier. I heard in the top of the hour newscast, 5 U.S. soldiers killed over there today or yesterday. And I'm thinking that the psychology behind, number one, being deployed there, spending however much time they're going through that hell on earth, and not having backing or having this kind of thing come up in your life due to an injury of any kind, it just mystifies me that thinking people could actually deliver this type of wreckage, because this is going to drive people to suicide and drugs, alcohol, and lots of other things.
It's certainly a problem, and I think at this point it's going to take the public pressing for this issue to be recognized for it to really come to a larger solution. Right now it's up to these individual soldiers and these families to seek treatment for their family members, soldier by soldier. It shouldn't be that way, and the veterans advocates who've been fighting this personality disorder battle for several years now are seeking situations where the soldiers can get the treatment they need and don't need to turn to self-medicating or self-treatment.
And not only the treatment they need, but the treatment they deserve, so rightfully deserve. Well, Joshua Kors, I can't thank you enough for joining. We got a break coming up here and got to move on, but thank you so much for taking time out. It was so good to talk to you recently after, it's been 6 years, 2001 it was when you wrote that article here for the Spectrum. And it sounds to me like things are going extremely well for you in your life, and I hope they continue. And no doubt you and I will continue to stay in touch. But I want to encourage you folks, as you said, it's going to take the public. It's going to take us to get out there and make some noise about issues like this. And this is a huge issue that I had no clue of, and I kind of link it to the Walter Reed debacle where it was kind of played down and covered up. And so is this a common fare for the military, or what do you think?
Absolutely. You know, what's going to be interesting at this point is to see what happens to Surgeon General Gail Pawlik in the wake of the Walter Reed scandal. The Pentagon took two actions. They accepted the resignation of Surgeon General Kevin Kiley, and they hired the public relations firm LMW Strategies with a $100,000 no-bid contract to put a positive spin on the scandal. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with Surgeon General Gail Pawlik in the wake of this $12.5 billion scandal.
Yeah, that'd be real interesting. I wish they'd give me $100,000 and I'll put a negative spin on it for them.
Dan, you know, it's great to see you're still on the air and have this opportunity with Fox News. I think you do an extremely important service, not just on a show about addiction and alcohol, but to do so in a community that doesn't want to recognize that drinking or addiction is happening at all.
That's really a great positive support term, a statement, Josh. And I, frankly, though, 9 years next month been on the air and really have encountered great amounts of support and encouragement from the community. And I think slowly but surely people are coming to realize that addiction is the number one health problem in this country today, and it affects us all, whether you think so or not.
You know, I remember when I was there in St. George, was there an outlet for AA and these other addiction groups, or was that simply a non-option?
No, AA has been around here for many years. NA has been here, Narcotics Anonymous, and CA and like that. What we didn't have when you were here and still don't have is any type of detox or inpatient treatment. A residential treatment of any kind. We do have tons of adolescent lockdown places here, as you probably remember. Last Monday, I had an opportunity to try to help a 38-year-old man detox, but I had to send him to Las Vegas through his family. They were able to get him down to Las Vegas, and I got a report last night that he is, in fact, still in detox, which is encouraging. But Las Vegas or Salt Lake is the nearest place if a person with an addiction problem needs, if they need help today, they need help today. They don't go into Vegas or Salt Lake is not conducive to getting help immediately.
Mm-hmm. So they have to treat them family by family, just like the soldiers.
That's right.
You know, one of the focuses of my reporting when I was there in St. George was about the diversity of culture that really isn't recognized. I did a piece, you know, first about you and your recognition of the addiction problems in Dixie, and also about the Jewish community there, which no one wants to look at, in the same way that no one wants to look at the polygamists that come in and out of Walmart every day. When you have kind of a monolithic culture with the LDS community there, it really helps people turn a blind eye to some of the larger issues that cross cultures, like addiction, like, in those cases, child brides.
Pregnancies and, like that. Yeah, exactly.
I think it's really important that people there open their eyes to some of the larger issues and recognize that, there's not just one community there. There are a host of people and a host of problems that need to be addressed outside simply the church.
That's a very astute point, Joshua. Of course, I like addiction, I reference that someone who's addicted to something for 10, 15, 20 years cannot turn that addiction around overnight. It takes time, and I think it's synonymous with the LDS culture, or any culture for that matter. For many, many years, the LDS has been the predominant culture here in the state, as you well know. And I know a lot of people. They're great, great people. I know many LDS people. But I think that culture opening to broader horizons is something that takes time, too, as well, if I could use that analogy.
It was a funny experience for me. Everyone always asked me here in New York and then where I come from in San Francisco what it was like to live there in St. George. And it was quite an experience. I think I understood it better after leaving and reading Under the Banner of Heaven, a fantastic book about the Mormon culture and the settling of the West. But for a liberal, for an atheist, to live out there, it was very interesting. I think in one way I fit in really well because I don't drink, I don't smoke. In that way, I'm really the sore thumb out here with all the bars. I just simply can't attend. I have no interest in drugs or alcohol. Never even had coffee. That's too far for me.
Really?
Yes. So I wouldn't have caffeine. It's just a personal dedication for me.
Well, you do fit in here.
In that sense, I fit in just fine. Finding a girl to date, I think, was tough. No one wanted to go outside the church. But there was a tremendous acceptance. You see in New York City the Mormon folks proselytizing on a personal level. That never happened once. I never had anyone come to me to try to convert me or press any of their beliefs. There was a real openness, but I don't think it yet extends to the point where other belief systems and other problems are recognized. You could almost argue that within the Mormon culture, addiction and denial really are the problem, because it's the people that grow up in those families that have parents that don't want to recognize their alcoholism and aren't going to come to their help and help them turn things around.
Well, to corroborate that, Joshua Kors, the prescription drug abuse problem number one in the country here in Utah, there's many, many other things that are blatantly lopsided when it comes to national averages and stuff. And so you're absolutely right. There's a stigma, a huge stigma, and a huge sense of denial. And I reference the D on the Hill here. If you've ever been to St. George, a huge D on the Hill, I reference that as standing for denial. But that didn't originate from me. I heard it originally when I came here 10 years ago. But, it's a complex issue, and nevertheless, I believe we're making some headway in that area, because I run into people all the time who come to the realization, maybe we do have a problem here. Maybe little Johnny does smoke a little too much pot or something like that.
Right. Well, that your show can be a wake-up call that way. Bill Maher talked about the issue you just touched on a minute ago in his last broadcast, where he said that, don't say your drugs are better than my drugs just because yours are legal. I mean, you look at Anna Nicole's situation where, as he phrased it, it was really her doctor that killed her. Yes. As soon as they got her body, she was just pumped full of all kinds of narcotics. You know, Rush Limbaugh faces the same situation. When legal drugs are the only option, people turn to that in abusive ways. I think, you know, there needs to be a larger discussion, you know, perhaps starting with your show, so that we can take a healthy look at drugs that are helpful to us and figure out how we can really establish lives that address drug addiction but don't involve them.
Well, it's an excellent point, and we can refer, I'd like to go back to someone like Elvis Presley, who abused prescription drugs to the bone, and of course they came from the medical community, and there's a psychology behind something that a doctor prescribes for me. Well, this is okay because my doctor gave it to me, therefore it's safe, and I know what, you know, it's legal, and yada yada, and there's a great tendency to abuse that because it's justified by my own rationale.
Yeah, so then each of these people are kind of left to make their own medical decisions. And I to go back to the soldiers, that's really what they're facing there. When you have people who are wounded, who are strained, to have them monitor their health in that way, when they're already ill, is just a touch too much, and I think that's when you find people going under, going AWOL, for example. They don't get any love or support from the military community after they disobey and walk off base. But if we could have caught them beforehand and say, wait a minute, this person's ill, maybe they do need medical treatment, maybe they are just one step from turning to drugs and alcohol, we could stop so many of these problems before they occur.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I really appreciate your perspective on the back to the soldiers, and let's get into something here that's a pet peeve of mine, if that's the right term, drinking and driving. This week in the Spectrum always has the arrest column, a little blotter. We've had 23 DUIs since last Monday that I personally counted. And this is common. It happens all the time. So those are just the ones that are getting caught. And that means that let's multiply that by 5 or 10, because there's probably at least that many more that are drinking, get away with it. But I bring that up simply because of that rationale, that justification happens across the country, around the world, I guess, from someone drinks 2 or 3 beers and says, well, I'm okay, I got a little buzz, but I've done this 150 times. Who are we accountable to? And do I have the ability to objectively look at my impairment? Well, no, I don't, because it's impaired, so I can't realistically get a correct answer. And so the same would apply with someone who's in the point of view of the soldiers, who are, number one, probably depressed and confused and angry and all these things about being denied medical treatment, and they have access to some illicit substance and like that. Very, very complex.
Sure, and it goes back to parenting. So many of these military families have been there for the soldiers in major ways. But sometimes that task is a touch too much to demand. I know Chris Mosier's family, the young soldier who committed suicide, his family did everything they could, and they were furious that they were left to their own devices to stop him from from turning against himself. With families there in St. George, if they want to address these issues before it comes to a DUI, they're going to need to really sit down at the dinner table and say, you know, here's what we have. What can we do to fix this problem?
That's a great point, because how many people actually will do that? They say addiction is a family disease, you're right, but generally the family has to walk around on eggshells and because of various components. But that's exactly right. To get it out there, I think I have a problem, I drink too much, or you shoot heroin on the weekends, or whatever the case may be, but this is exactly what exacerbates the problem. People don't discuss it because it's a secretive type of behavior.
And here in New York, where there's a bar on every corner and, you know, drunk people spill out into the streets, discussing alcohol is no big deal. You know, this is what happens in the blue states. It's more accessible, but in many ways it's less of a problem for the mainstream community because it can be discussed, it can be handled. People can take their own avenues. Drugs were readily available when I grew up in the suburbs of San Francisco, but it just wasn't for me. I was much more interested in tennis and journalism. Mm-hmm. And it's only when it becomes something taboo that it becomes something alluring. And that's when, you know, the listeners you have today need to ask themselves, you know, does my kid have a problem, or do I just not know about it because I haven't raised the issue?
Yeah, that's so true. Two weeks ago, Josh, I had a three or four kids from Cross Creek Programs out in Leverkin, and a therapist, Garth Lassiter. That's about, I don't know, 20 times I've had him on the show over the years, and because they're in a lockdown adolescent treatment for substance abuse and runaway incorrigibility, and it's just a dynamic program each time, because we have these young women in particular, young girls in their teens who at 11, 12, 13 started smoking pot, drinking, using drugs, and ended up, their parents have to actually hijack them and get them into treatment, and they end up at Cross Creek. And Cross Creek, in my opinion, being one of the finest programs available in the country for helping kids in crisis. So it's just, most of them will say, well, you know, I got away with it for 2 or 3 years, nobody in the family knew, and then it, you know, it propagated from there.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think a lot of times the family does know but doesn't want to know.
Sure, of course, very astute. Yeah. Joshua, of course, listen, bud, I got to get out of here, but thank you so much for taking time to join me, and for everyone that has just tuned in, perhaps, Joshua Kors, calling live from New York this morning. JoshuaKors.com, K-O-R-S, that's one word, JoshuaKors, K-O-R-S.com. Go there, and you'll find out what we're talking about. You can click on the Veterans Benefits Scandal, which is salient to exactly what we talked about here this morning, and how it relates to you and me and everyone else. And, Josh, keep up the tremendous work you're doing. I really admire you for all the things that you do. And I hope you continue. And my honor and pleasure to know you and to have you on the show, John.
Thanks, Dan. You keep up the public service, and I will keep you informed as to what's happening with these wounded veterans. Perhaps we'll do an update sometime down the road.
Yeah, let's do that soon, okay, Joshua?
You take care.
Thanks a lot, buddy. See you then. All right, that's Joshua Kors. What a great human being he is, and I got to know him here in St. George when he worked for the Spectrum as a writer, and he has been around. This guy has been around, and he's worked radio and TV and newspapers and magazines. And what prompted this interview today, of course, was the article he wrote in Nation magazine about our soldiers, 22,000 thus far, being caught up in a scandal that he so succinctly writes about in Nation magazine. JoshuaKors.com. Go there, and you'll see what it's about.